You're tuned in to 90.1 FM KPFT, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio streaming at kpft.org. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 25 listener candidates. This is an announcement from one of them.
My name is Henry Faust, and I'm running for the KPFT local board. And I have lots of experience writing proposals for grants, managing grants, and also managing budgets. So some of the things I would bring to the board would be the idea that I'm going to work with a very experienced grant writer, and that we could work on a proposals for grants. Some other ideas are possibly the idea to promote broadcasts from various locations and also get local businesses more involved.
To learn more about KPFT local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
Pacifica owned and listener supported for over 50 years. This is 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1 Houston.
Rick Rhodes is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Rhodes to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the only state to carry out executions in 2021. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan Snyder, special guest Pat McCann, a Houston defense lawyer specializing in Texas appellate remedies, and a live interview with mitigation expert Victoria Rusk. The Execution Watch for Rick Rhodes begins. Will a thousand be enough? One life. And we're not giving up. One's too many.
Hello. We bring you breaking news on this Wednesday, September 28th edition of Execution Watch, the only electronic vigil held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. Now, the first hour of KPFT's Blues and Hi-Fi with Clint Broussard will be preempted tonight. The second half of the show will be air starting about 7 p.m. Meanwhile, for the next hour, Execution Watch will broadcast live news coverage of the execution of Rick Rhodes by the state of Texas. The state of Texas plans to execute 57-year-old Rick Rhodes, condemned in the 1991 murders of the brothers Charles and Bradley Allen. Mr. Rhodes' attorney previously sought a stay of execution from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the Fifth U.S. Circuit of Appeals, both of which were denied. On Monday, a new application for a stay was submitted to the Supreme Court. It was also denied. Before we go into today's case, I want to reach out to John Ramirez, who received a stay after we went off the air on September the 8th. I apologize to you for the airing of your interview conducted by our legal analyst, Larry Douglas. These interviews are making a difference. They're reaching people around the globe, and the more the people know, the more voices to end the death penalty. We wanted the world to hear from you. There are listeners around the globe who care about what is happening to you. You are connecting. Communication from the death house and the Supreme Court is tough and near to impossible during our show, and mix-ups are tough to avoid. We are trying to improve that and have reached out as recently as today requesting that someone at TDCJ call our staff after 6 p.m. during executions. Our producers reached out to every inmate with an execution date on death row since the inception of this show to tell us their stories, and we hope that we will continue to do so. Mr. Ramirez, I hope you will forgive us. For those of you new to Execution Watch, this program is the first and only live electronic vigil providing firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We hope that these live reports from people standing vigil outside the death house in Huntsville, Texas, are the closest you will ever come to the walls unit. Built in 1849, and this was once a Confederate prison and is the only one still standing and in continuous use. Tonight, we go to our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Linda, thank you for joining us.
Okay, they just crossed the line, the witnesses.
Do we know who's actually standing in witness?
Yes, Adina, his friend, and then another friend. Two friends are with him.
So there will be someone there.
Yes, there's two girlfriends. Not girlfriends, but just friends.
And the crowd outside, are there people there?
Yes, they're here. We don't have as many tonight as we've had before. But we've got like eight people here.
And of course, these are all members of the Texas to abolish the death penalty. Different people
yes.
who stand in solidarity against the death penalty.
Right.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you for letting us know. They've crossed. Please let us know when they come back out.
I sure will. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. That's our reporter, Linda Snyder. And joining us today in the studio, to put this case in perspective, is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Our special guest, Pat McCann, Houston defense attorney, expert in Texas appellate and post-conviction remedies. Gentlemen, I bring it to you. How did we get here? Tell us about this case.
Well, Marlo, this case happened back in 1991. The brothers, Charles and Bradley Allen, were found murdered found dead in their house by a neighbor. About a month later, Rick Allen Rhodes was arrested in the process of committing a burglary in another location. And while he was in custody for that burglary, he provided the police a written statement detailing the fact that he had been the person who did the killing. He explained to them that he had gotten out of prison in their selection of jurors, particularly as in its removal of, Rick Rhodes is black, and it's in its removal.
No.
Not?
No.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that was a straight Batson challenge.
It was a straight Batson.
Yeah, and he's right. The issue survives until now, and it's actually the subject of the last stay request, which went, they went to Anna Martinez, the judge in that court, and asked her for access to the jury questionnaires to see if black jurors had been improperly excluded. She refused to determine whether or not they had shown good cause, so they tried to mandamus her via the Court of Criminal Appeals. Four of those judges actually did want to decide this issue because there are several parts of the Code of Criminal Procedure that have not been explored, either in relation to a capital case or what the definitions are in the legislation. And one of them is this, which allows a trial court to give access to confidential juror information upon a showing of good cause. And that's essentially for someone to go in on a motion for new trial or a habeas writ to try and correct an injustice by looking in to see whether a juror was improperly influenced or biased. Here, they were trying to see if the jurors were excluded improperly. So they were trying to get access to what we call the juror questionnaires for trials. And juror questionnaires have a wealth of highly personal information, which is why this statute was put in, because in the days, as you were talking about with Johnny Holmes, they used to just be filed with the appellate record. So anybody could access them. And it was, there was a lot of information you would not want in the public arena. So they did this, but they left a safety valve for people to come in later and look at them. Here on a death penalty case, the two lawyers, Mr. Newberry and Mr. Dow, were trying very hard to get information about the Batson challenge. It's a structural issue. It's important to all the federal courts. Judge Martinez did not determine whether or not they'd shown good cause. And in fairness, this is a claim that's now, you know, 30 years old. It may have been able to have been brought a lot sooner than this. She refused to decide whether or not they'd gotten good cause. So they took it to a mandamus in the CCA and then up through the district, Fifth Circuit, and now the Supreme Court. And it's a fascinating legal issue for nerds like myself, because the this is about whether if the state law creates a right and then denies someone access to that, have they created a civil rights violation? And that's the question that they brought to the federal courts. And it's a huge thing because, like you've talked about, I think, before, about the fact that it, you know, requires a state judge to sign off on the execution. And in theory, they can take that back if they find good cause. That's an issue that's never been explored. This issue has never been explored, whether, for instance, in a capital case, and this is the most serious of all cases, whether or not this right needs to be given a different lens. In other words, if I'm 30 years ago on an habitual burglary charge, okay, you've had your chance to do this. We were talking, you know, about that. But now you're about to be executed. Is there a more compelling interest of the individual and of the system to look at this? And it's a creative and interesting issue. It just, Supreme Court has decided not to review it, which means that, sadly, I think we're about to get news that he's been executed.
So what else do we need to know particularly? I mean, he's had a couple of stays. He's certainly gone through the system at this point in time. Do you have anything to say, Mike?
I still would make the argument that this is not a capital offense. If I want to look at it differently, what I see is a man who just got out of prison. And let's face reality. Being in prison like he was makes a man mean and hard. He's just out. He's not dropped off at a halfway house where they can accumulate in society. They drop him off at a bus station. In my experience, those guards have shotguns. They stand on the street and let these guys off the bus with shotguns on them, then they back on the bus. They're letting dangerous people out on the street. And at some time in life, we got to blame the government for this. Within 24 hours, he goes back to his own neighborhoods. Now, everything we know about this case is what he tells us. I don't know what else there is besides what he tells us. And what he tells us is that he went back to his own neighborhood. He didn't go to commit crime. He didn't go with a weapon. He didn't go with the intention of hurting anybody. He went to his neighborhood and got in a fight with somebody. We don't know if he knew this person or not. For all we know, this was the bully that used to beat him up when he was a kid. We don't know. What we do know is they got in a fight in the street. The fight went to the house where the man had a knife. Then his brother jumped in. Why isn't that a mutual fight in self-defense? I'm not saying it is. But it's an argument that I think that can be made to a court to say that this is not an intentional act, that he went there for a purpose, committing a felony, and killed two people in the process of the felony.
I agree that today they may not seek death, but I have to agree with Larry that this fit the statute. In Holmes's day, anyone who fit the statute, didn't matter who you killed, didn't matter how it happened, you just were charged and they sought death and let the jury decide.
But my question is it malpractice to argue what I just did? That he did not deliberately go kill two people, that it was a mutual. So it's an argument for lawyers to make. And it's an argument that a jury can pick as an alternative to the death penalty.
And Beck v. Alabama talks about the fact that you can have a lesser in there. And I think that would have been an excellent strategy. The problem is here that, as Larry said, you have a fellow, regardless of how a fight in the street starts, the other fellow retreats into his house. At that point, this guy follows him into his house, continues the fight. So he breaks into the house. He's burglarizing the house, continues the fight to commit an assault. His brother wakes up, joins the fight. This guy's hard, like you say, and he kills both of them.
Don't
but that's
see burglary. I see a man from TDC just out. He's going to follow that fight because that's the kind of man he is, and he has not been accumulated to be a civilian yet. He did what he had to do as the next convict on the street.
Do you think that's fair about the old Bluebird specials that used to drop people, just drop them off?
Do I think it's fair?
I'm just asking.
I really don't. But this case raises. There were some very interesting issues that were raised by the case, not just the Batson issue, but in capital cases, one of the primary concerns, we've got the future dangerousness, which you mentioned earlier, and then the flip side of that is mitigation. And one of the things that he had sought to have done in mitigation was that at least let me show photographs. The lawyer says, at least let me show photographs of my client as a child, going to play baseball, you know, going to dances and so forth, to normalize him when they have already made him sound like a monster.
Right.
And the court did not allow them to introduce any of those photographs.
Well, again, this is 1992, right?
It was, but at the same time, that it just seems as though that it wasn't. We only have so much as defense lawyers,
right?
And it needs to be something of some fairness to at least. It would not have hurt to at least allow one of the photos, or several of the photos, to be admitted, and the DA even raised the issue of him being furloughed if he were to get life in prison. That he might be able to get out and do all, and that's kind of preposterous, the thought that it was going to happen, but the court looked at it and said, well, it could have happened. And you say, well, it wasn't going to happen in his case, but that was allowed there, and in a capital case, if the defense cannot put on as much evidence as it desires to do. Reasonable evidence that the jury could use could use to decide on his fate. Something as simple as allowing his lawyers to introduce the evidence of the photographs of him as a young child in mitigation. That kind of set me it didn't set well with me.
Right.
That you don't have to stack the deck. That he probably would have gotten death penalty anyway. I don't know, but he should have been allowed to at least have a chance in putting that evidence on.
Well,
in mitigation,
it just so happens that we have a mitigation specialist with us right now, Ms. Victoria Rusk. Of course, she is the author of the Handbook for Mitigation, published by heartofchange.org. And we're very happy to have you here with us today, Victoria. Let's talk a little bit about mitigation as it really relates to kind of what we're talking about right now. How does it work? How would it have worked?
Well, according to deathpenaltyinfo.org, the article that was sent to us this afternoon, Mr. Rhodes had at trial evidence of a head injury and child abuse as a child. But I think that the head injury definitely played some mitigating circumstances around the actual crime. And present day, that information could, be presented to get the death penalty waived. Now, back in 1991, 92, no, they were not bringing in neuroscience to the courtroom. And so I think that a person who suffers from a head injury very likely can be a little bit more aggressive and or because they're suffering from depression because of the health of their brain. And the other thing, like you were saying, I'm sorry, tell me your name again.
Michael.
Like he was sharing with us about how he got pushed off the bus. So what not only did he have a head injury at some time in his 20s or even in his childhood, that he was in such a vulnerable state being fresh out of prison. Mm-hmm. And so what happens whenever you're incarcerated is that you don't have some of the hormones that you need in your brain to navigate the world and deal with the stresses of the world.
Right.
So he was, some people would say a hardened criminal, but I would say he was very vulnerable that he didn't have certain hormones that would help protect him and his brain and navigating life for that 24, 48 hours and or 1 month that he had. So to me, as a mitigation specialist, that head injury would have been fully investigated and applied to the guilt-innocent phase of the trial.
And these are things that, especially, how would you have brought them into something like the punishment phase?
Well, specific for the punishment phase, I mean, that would have been part of, you know, how he made decisions, what got him in prison the first time, right? And how he would have made decisions, because he probably didn't get mitigation investigation, you know, during that first crime, right?
Right.
Totally. And so bringing in, you know, the condition of his brain as mitigation evidence, especially in capital cases, present day, we get brain scans.
Huh.
And they're more common now than definitely in the 90s. He wouldn't have had access to that. So, you know, comparing present day to the 90s is apples and oranges. It does not make any sense. But in the 90s and then moving forward in the appellate process, that's something that could have come up. But when you're doing an ineffective assistant claim in an appeal, it's just what actually did happen and what tools did they have during the 90s that they didn't have access to. And the child abuse and how you were saying about them not being able to bring in the photos. I mean, to me, those photos would have come in through a mitigation witness like a parent, maybe a school teacher if it was a school photo, and said, this is the Mr. Rhodes that I knew. And this is what was going on during, and even though I knew, didn't know maybe this or that, I did know this part of this person. So they can, mitigation witnesses can testify to a chapter of a person's life and what they saw and what they witnessed, right? And or you don't know that one of the witnesses could have been a person who witnessed the child abuse, and they would be able to testify to such things. If Mr. Rhodes was in CPS and or there was some Texas Health and Human Service records about his parents or what was going on with them in their family, you know, police reports, if it was a domestic violence thing and police did get involved, there's all this kind of evidence. There could have even been that actual cop who went to the domestic violence, you know, all these are hypothetical examples because I don't know exactly what happened or wasn't going on in trial in 1992, but this is mitigation evidence that perhaps a police officer who answered a domestic violence call to his parents' house, that they would be able to testify to what happened in that police report. And that's bringing in that that child abuse that would be then showcased to the jury to see if they can connect, because we don't know unless they're in the jury interviews, if anybody on the jury was a victim of child abuse, or if they had been, you know, a teacher or a pastor of children who had experienced child abuse in their life. You know, you don't know that those photos wouldn't have been the same backdrop to juror number six, the same backdrop to their childhood, you know, photos, because they might have been around the same age, or they could have been a parent of a kid around his age, because he was like 27 years old. I mean, he was barely past the age of a full developed brain.
And he's been in prison for decades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on that point, Marlo, the thing that concerned me was the way that the trial court seem to not pay close enough attention to the necessity, well, the value of having the photos come in, and was so willing to accept the prosecutor's attitude about the photos. Prosecutor didn't want them to come in.
Why so blasé?
Well, the prosecutor's position was that the photographs themselves were not even mitigating, saying that it very well might be interpreted by, this argument was to the judge.
Right.
This could be interpreted by the jury as actually being more, making him more culpable, in that the argument is, well, everybody's got a childhood, and everybody's got childhood photos. Mm-hmm. So if we let those childhood photos in to try to normalize him from the monster that the prosecutors created, then that would show that he had a normal childhood. And despite the fact that he was raised by loving parents and had a normal childhood, he still did what he did in any event. So he's even more culpable than someone who might have had an abusive childhood. That was the argument, and the judge agreed with that. And said, that makes sense. It might be more damaging to him than mitigating, and which just made no sense to me at all. When I read that, I just couldn't believe it.
Go ahead.
No, you please go ahead.
This is always the issue with mitigation. And in fact, Justice O'Connor talked about double-edged mitigation. For instance, there was a reluctance prior to the Atkins decision to bring in low IQ and learning disabilities or even actual mental retardation, because there was a theory that was popular among some defense attorneys that, well, people look at that and say he can't learn from anything, he can't control his behavior. That's been disavowed and taken care of through a series of court decisions, but these are the things people faced in the days, in those times, and how to present mitigation evidence was also something that, since the statute had just changed in that session, mm-hmm. I think was also an issue as to how to investigate, uncover, as Victoria said, the amount of work that one has to do to explain this guy's life to people. Is enormous, and the Supreme Court has weighed in on that to say, of all the things that we do, this is the most important function, is to counter the punishment evidence.
I just want to say, if you're listening on KPFT 90.1 FM, it is 6:30. Thank you for joining us. This is a special edition of Execution Watch. Blues and Hi-Fi will be on at the top of the hour. So what does the Supreme Court have to say about all of this? I mean,
on mitigation?
Yeah. How is it helping to avoid arbitrary application of the death penalty?
Nothing other than elimination of the death penalty is going to help eliminate arbitrary application of the death penalty. So let's be clear about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To lessen it, the court has, through a series of decisions, decided that we want to narrow the category of offenders who merit execution. In other states, they do it by aggravating and mitigating circumstances. We do it, Mike, up front by having special categories that the prosecutors often refer to as murder plus.
Can
murder
you explain
plus
that?
The intentional killing of a child under 10. Murder plus the killing of a fireman or a police officer or a corrections officer in the course of their duties, when you know when they're in the course of their duties. Murder plus another person killed, as Larry said, in this case, two people in the course of the same, or more, in the course of the same criminal transaction. So Texas narrows it by funneling the group of eligible people. The Supreme Court has expanded on the way down the factors that can be mitigating. First, by requiring that mitigation be heard, and that was honestly the Penry decision back in 89. The state legislature modified that in 91. So this would have been one of the first cases that had the new statute, which replaced deliberateness as a question with mitigation. Mm. But being one of the first, I feel badly for the lawyers, because they would have had no judge that had ever funded this.
Right.
And no experience trying to present this. Mm-hmm. But as Larry says, we only need one. We need one juror at some phase of this to say no. At the future danger phase, if they say no, or if at the mitigation question, they look and say, yes, there is enough mitigation here for me to impose a sentence other than death.
Interesting.
So in that sense, in the same way at guilt or innocence, where we only need one to hang the jury, in this case, if we get one on those answers, we're done. Fellow goes to prison for the rest of his life. And at this time, I think in 91 or 92, the statute was 15-year parole eligibility, so that was also a problem, because people were getting paroled all the time. But, this is on the furlough issue. honestly, if Johnny's people weren't cheating, they weren't trying at that point. Does
anybody think that this would have been a capital case if he had just not been released from prison? And what I'm suggesting is that the future dangerousness was the overwhelming factor in this case.
I think yes, because the facts of the case alone would have pro two people killed in hand-to-hand combat would have shown that this guy was a future danger no matter what you did. But I think there's a case that can be made now. As Victoria described so eloquently, it's not someone who's a hardened criminal, it's someone who's a vulnerable criminal who's been released from a horrible environment into a place where he has no tools to deal with that environment. There's no, in those days, there were no halfway houses, you know, or very few. And they didn't deliver them to a halfway house unless they were instructed to by parole. So I totally agree with you that nowadays things are better in terms of trying to get people prepared for reentry. But they're so far from good, but they're better than they were.
Forget about him out of prison. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about a burglary. What is the proof there was another crime? I mean, question to you, they don't got to prove burglary in this case. They can just talk about it.
No, they have to prove the underlying crime.
But then how do they prove it?
Simple.
There was nothing taken. There was nothing.
No, you can make a burglary to commit an assault. That's what this was.
Okay. If I'm in the street and I'm attacked and the fight goes into the house, that's the question. Is it a burglary or not? Am I following to continue the fight? I come to burglarize. I think there's a distinction between a man committing a crime and killing during the crime and a man being, maybe he was jumped. Maybe he was the one who was a victim. Maybe he continued the fight in the house. But there's an argument I can say that this is just a fight and two people were killed, which is a travesty. But I think they picked future dangerousness first, and then they went to the death penalty.
Oh, absolutely. Every evaluation made in the 90s was based on, can I prove future danger, and what does he have for mitigation?
But that's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be the crime is supposed to be bad enough to make future dangerous an issue. It's not supposed to be future dangerousness that we think makes it a crime.
I wish that were true, but that's not how a prosecutor prosecuting a death penalty thinks. They have to be able to get the death penalty, otherwise why are they doing it? Mm-hmm. And the way you get the death penalty is proving future danger and negating mitigation.
Yeah, but at what point in time do they just say this is a horrible crime, we're going to put him in prison for the rest of his life?
Well, once you got LWOP in 2006, this went down dramatically. But in the 91, no. Honestly.
And there have been so many changes over the past several years. I mean, we're sitting here in 2021. Texas has executed a couple of people this year. This is the first from Harris County.
Which is amazing, almost, this is the first from Harris County. It's been so long.
There have been significant changes in public sentiment. And also in the prosecutor's attitude.
Well, that's right. Is it the public sentiment or is it Kim Ogg?
It's both. Okay, it's both. I mean, she's an elected official. And she ran on the platform of reducing the number of death penalties sought, I believe. And she's been focused. Now you still got to enforce the law. But seeking the death penalty, and as Pat just mentioned, you know, having life without parole makes a huge difference in whether death needs to be sought anyway, because life without parole is a remedy that was not available back then.
It's a horrible remedy.
Let's go back to our reporter in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Linda.
Yes, at 6:34, the witnesses crossed the line coming back out. He is now dead. His witnesses are out here if y'all would like to speak to them.
We'd very much like to speak with them, please.
Hold on.
Again, you are listening to Execution Watch on KPFT 90.1 FM and here at Houston Media Source in the studio. We are speaking with our reporter, Linda Snyder, who is outside the house.
Would you
And they she's going to the witnesses have already come back across the road.
They just want to ask you
that the execution has taken place. And Rick Rhodes is now deceased. Let's go back to Linda. Linda, who do you have with you?
Dignified.
I have Andrea.
I'm Dina.
Oh, Dina, sorry.
Hello, Andrea.
Very dignified.
No, this is Dina.
Am I on?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
He was very courageous and very dignified and very loving and very brave. And he had a lot of people that loved him and supported him. He was very grateful for that. And he was thinking of all of us who love him. He was putting us first. And, you know.
Did you get to speak with him?
Just a champion till the end. He was really brave. That's all I have to say.
Andrea, okay. Thank you. Thank you for sharing with us. Linda, did you by any chance get to speak with Rick in the days preceding this?
No, I did not.
All right.
I didn't.
That was, of course, Andrea Andeas, and she was one of the witnesses for Rick Rhodes. They will be.
Actually, that was Dina. That was Dina that was talking to you.
Oh,
I got the name wrong.
My apologies. Thank you. Anything else for us, Linda?
No, that's it. Thank you.
We really appreciate what you all are doing. Thank you very much. And let's bring it back here into the studio again, here at Houston Media Source Studio, where, of course, we have our panel of experts and our guests, Pat McCann, Victoria Rusk, Larry Douglas, and Mike Gillespie. Gentlemen, we were...
Let me ask Victoria a question.
Please.
How do you mitigate brutal facts? You're talking about mitigating his life to show his side, but how do you mitigate the facts of a brutal crime?
I don't. I mitigate a person, not a crime.
Okay. So how do you, but do you think it's important to minimize? Let me tell you something that I do.
Okay.
I believe that I always outlaw color photographs. I come to court with black and white photographs. I feel can argue the black and white photographs show more detail. Black and white photographs don't inflame a jury. Black and white photographs show the facts more neutral than color does. What do you think of that?
Crime scene photos?
Yeah.
I love that theory.
What do you think of that, Pat?
I think it works especially legally for the fact that the purpose of admitting the photos in the first place is to prove identity and extent of the wounds. So a black and white photograph does do a better job of that with less gore.
More than jurors will look at it. Where the gore, they're going to just chill away from.
That's right.
But am I on the right track that this should be what's presented in court, neutral black and white photographs of crime scenes rather than blood and cuts? And at what point in time are they deliberately inflating the jury, getting them mad at people?
Yeah. Well, and that's something that, you know, we have to take in consideration on what's going to cause emotional reaction by the jury. And so what you're doing is being, you know, protective of the jury. And that's not necessarily what the prosecutor is doing.
I find jurors like it. They see that, especially when they see the photographs, they now see what I was arguing, and they now understand why I was trying to shield them from it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to get them to be able to hear you a little bit better, as like you're presenting information as factual as possible. And but when it comes to, you know, photos for mitigation, I would rather have them in color if we can. But I see what you're saying, guilt-innocent phase. Yeah, I definitely would want to do the best that you can to present the facts, present your evidence, and in a way that jurors will want to participate and be engaged in the dialogue.
And in a sense, before the Supreme Court made the test for the death penalty, the concept of future dangerousness, wasn't that kind of resolved in the prison yard among inmates without being done to a jury? Didn't they decide who was future dangerousness?
I'm not really sure that that's either a relevant or an appropriate question in this case, because we can't answer it. But
I know, but it's
But as far as you're talking about, and if I'm tracking you right, you want to let the jurors know what these guys went through in prison in order to sit there and make them understand why they reacted violently. Is that fair?
I might believe that, but that's okay. Not what I was saying now, but I do believe that a man coming out of TDC is a different man than a man never been in TDC. Mm-hmm. I think he needs to be judged different than other people judge. For example, the same man coming out of TDC would have been more likely to jump in and stop a crime seen committed than me or you, because he's more used to action. That doesn't make him a bad person, it makes him an action person. And again, I would take the argument, and I didn't see the trial, but at what point in time do we know that he wasn't a victim of an assault and he wasn't following through the fight with these one man, then a brother jumped in?
Okay, and here's where I think it's important that people understand, though, that all you need for a burglary is an improper entry, okay? And if you cross the threshold of a door, you've burgled the space without permission.
But you need intent.
Well, but he's intending to go whoop this guy's ass. So
that's not burglary. That's an assault. That's not a burglary.
You commit a burglary when you enter a premises to commit another crime. Theft, assault, sexual assault.
Why is it not self-defense? He was being attacked. And by the way, he's the one saying these bad things about himself.
Sure.
The worst that can happen is what he's saying. Mm-hmm. I also say, what did they introduce in court to prove that he did these things? It's his own words. They took his own words and made it the worst crime possible and killed him because of it.
And on that point, Michael, I do think that, and I'm sure that it was done at trial, that since the information regarding the killings came primarily from him, that the argument is that, you know, this should say something about the kind of person that he is, okay? That is, coming forward and admitting to what he did, taking responsibility for it.
He confessed because he had a guilty conscience. That was the first step of rehabilitation, that he felt bad and he confessed he had to get off his consciences and confess to the police. And keep something else in mind. Let's assume for a second that it wasn't that bad. Let's assume for a second that he knew he was going back in prison because he was on parole and he didn't want to go back to prison. Could it be that he was committing suicide by death penalty? Now I want to live the rest of life in prison?
He's been there for 30 years after this.
I know.
And I do think we need to at least talk a little bit about the family members of the Allen brothers. It's been 30 years, and I've seen some issues, some comments about them saying, we're just tired. We're really tired of dealing with this. We've got two brothers who were killed on September 13th, 1991. And the family has had to go through this each and every time anything occurred. You know, and he's been in prison. He's been on death row for a long time. That suffering, I mean, you mentioned that you think life without parole is also inhumane. But it's for a lot of people, it saved a lot of lives. It's actually saved a lot of lives. But this family, you know, has suffered. I just want to just make sure that we don't have their suffering go unnoticed.
It is unfair to even talk about these men doing anything wrong, because there's nothing that I can say they did wrong except defend themselves. It's just that I see so many people get into fistfights and these things happening. And again, the answer was 91. I just don't see this being a death penalty case today. Which gets to the next question. Are we supposed to reevaluate it based upon the modern days? Are we supposed to continue with the idea of hanging them when they were a thief and cutting their hands off when they're thieves?
I would hope, and to give Kim Ogg and Josh Reese, the head of the Writs Division in Harris County, their due. They have looked at some of the older cases and have not sought death dates, I believe, because they believe it would not be a death penalty case now.
Good.
And Kim has instituted a committee that reviews these now, because before, it was very simple. Johnny Holmes would allow his chief prosecutors to make the initial decision, and it was reviewed in a cursory rubber stamp way by the supervising division chiefs and then Johnny, but Johnny's attitude was, my chief, I gave my chief discretion and power for a reason. If they approved it, I'll approve it. And nowadays, that is not the case. It's reviewed by a group of people. I wish it was a more community open process rather than the closed process of a group of prosecutors. But she has done an amazing thing in terms of looking at this from a group perspective rather than, and a discussion rather than a straight rubber stamp highway.
Is that something that other counties should be looking into? Because it sounds like a better system than one person making a decision on somebody's life.
I hope so. I hope that they will all adopt a similar system. I hope that they will expand it to include community members, since the community is going to have to decide this question ultimately anyway. But that's, you know, up to, and this goes to discretion on this, and this is why it's important. There are 254 counties in this state. The majority of the counties that put people to death has always been Harris first, then Dallas, then a few small counties that have a surprisingly aggressive attitude. Harris has decreased their prosecutions and their executions. However, there are other counties that have bitten the bullet. Brazos County, I believe Williamson County is seeking death on a new case. I may be off on that, perhaps I'm behind the curve, but Collin County has now become a source of death penalty cases. I believe that conservatives, rural counties or suburban counties have become the new Dallas or the new Harris.
Can you look at it in terms of Republicans and Democrats or just in terms of geographical restrictions?
I don't have those figures, so that I don't have the answer to that. I would have to look. I can tell you that among progressive Democrats, the death penalty is anathema, but to be fair, there are also conservative Democrats who, for the right crime, are not opposed to the death penalty. Lucky Ward was a death case that Harris County sought a year ago and got. So there are cases and times when even someone who doesn't want to enforce the death penalty will have to under law. And honestly, that's probably going to involve multiple people, cops or kids, to be fair. So that it is still a reality with us, and it will be for some time.
And if we follow the money, is it becoming in the slightest bit prohibitive? Is it really becoming more of a community issue now that the tax bases have changed? There's been...
No. And here... It was at one point for rural counties on a basis of cost, but two things have happened to make these cases affordable to try for the counties and affordable to defend. One is the governor's grants to any county under $250,000 that seeks to impose a death penalty. There are grants available from the government's office and the governor's office to subsidize those prosecutions. That allows them to hire experts, pro tem prosecutors who have death penalty experience, appellate lawyers to help them with that. And the other, in my opinion, has been the RPDO, which has contracts with smaller counties to defend these issues. Now, to be fair to the RPDO, they do an amazing job of trying
what
to get
What is the
death.
RPDO?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Regional Public Defender's Office.
Thank you.
Which is a group of very dedicated public defenders employed in areas throughout the state where there is not a vigorous death penalty bar like there is in Harris County.
Right.
And to their credit, They have done tremendous things to get death off the table, and they have fought tooth and nail on the trials. But money is not really an issue anymore, if I may be. It should be to the taxpayer. It should be
to the taxpayer. Who's paying for it at this point?
Is money an issue? Jimmy used to always be concerned.
Right.
The cost of keeping people in prison, especially people with limited disabilities, is going to cause the government to do more executions to limit the cost of incarceration.
No,
but as we do this more, it's going to be quicker, more efficient.
Oh, no.
You think it's always going slow. To be, every case is going to be like this, okay.
It's slowed tremendously because the funding has increased. The lawyers have gotten better. The opportunity to get rid of these early has developed. We have skilled mitigation specialists who help us, neuroscience is introduced, so you get a much more expensive trial, a much more expensive appeal, and a very expensive and lengthy habeas process. So to be honest, the figures I quoted are probably vastly out of date in terms of the cost of an execution versus the cost of simple incarceration for life without parole.
I just want to ask one more question of Victoria. Mitigation, is it working?
Yes, I think mitigation is working. I definitely think that, you know, like Pat was sharing, that it has slowed down executions because death gets waived as a possibility of punishment early on. And then I think introducing mitigation does mitigate sentences because people can connect to the life story of this person. And I've seen it in action myself in 2019. We got a life sentence in Fort Bend County. And my client didn't even have a lot of the neuroscience that was brought to the table. It was really the jury selected in that trial was crying at conviction and crying at punishment.
All right, well, this has been fascinating. It's been a very interesting and lively discussion, and I thank you all for being here. It is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us on October the 12th when Texas plans to usher Stephen Barbie into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, find us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, where you can also get on our mailing list for all the latest updates. Thank you to our guests, Victoria Rusk and Pat McCann, our panel, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter Linda Snyder, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, KPFT and Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor Otis McClay, KPFT's Dakota Sampson, and Houston Media Source technical producer Mark Pirtle. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, thank you and good night.
children of God. It's insane. In Jesus' name. Where's all that religious passion? You know they're killing people.